So you see,
I'm Shepard Siegel. I wrote Disruptive Play, The Trickster in Politics and Culture. And my new book is called Tricking Power into Performing Acts of Love, How Tricksters Through History Have Changed the World. And boy, it's all about having fun and being playful. And I hope you're being playful here at KZSC 88.1 on your FM dial.
The following interview with Shepard Siegel was originally broadcast on May 26, 2022. This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org, broadcasting from the University of California at Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. Today you'll hear an interview with Shepard Siegel, author of the book Tricking Power into Performing Acts of Love, How Tricksters Through History Have Changed the World. The book is set for release on June 5th. Siegel highlights artists and activists who have disrupted the status quo, like Abby Hoffman, the Marx Brothers, Mae West, Richard Pryor, Sun Ra, Yoko Ono, Spike Lee, the Yes Men, Earth First, and others. His first book, Disruptive Play, The Trickster in Politics and Culture, was published in 2018. Shepard Siegel lived in Santa Cruz for 11 years, from 1971 to 1982, when his father was the project manager for building Stevenson College at UCSC. Siegel worked for decades in public education and has lived in Seattle, Washington for many years. Here now is Shepard Siegel. You know, right off, you point out, which I agree with completely, and everyone seems to be, you know, agreeing that we are in a bit of a state now that our political, environmental, social, education systems are really a mess. And maybe during the pandemic, the beginning of the pandemic, I've never heard more people saying that out loud around the world. And, you know, in one way, especially around systems of safety and policing, and do we even want police? And you're pointing to the fact that a lot of these problems are rooted in an abuse of power. And then that power must be tricked out of power, and the powerless have only the trick as their resource. So tell me about, you know, your point of view of the root of some of our suffering now being the abuse of power. Because power, I think about this regularly, power itself is an energy, and it depends how it's used. So you're pointing to the abuse of power as being the root of some of our problems. And then a good solution would be tricking that power, especially if you don't have traditional means of power. Tell me about that relationship.
Sure. And I'm not so sure about the word must, that it must be tricked out, but it does happen. And I think it's a phenomenon of tricking power, and hopefully tricking power into performing acts of love, that we should not ignore. I think what you read came from a San Francisco prankster. You know, there's that group up in San Francisco called Research, and their book on pranks, which is an anthology, is quite profound and talks about people tricking power. But let me give you three quick examples. I'm speaking to you from Seattle, Washington. I've lived here for quite a while now. And here in the Pacific Northwest, you know, the indigenous culture, every culture on the planet has a trickster god. And the indigenous cultures here, the trickster god is the raven. And raven tails, in fact, extend as far south as Northern California, and all the way to British Columbia, the Aleutian Islands, and Siberia. Among indigenous peoples in that whole swath of the planet, you'll find raven tails. So the cover of the book pictures the raven, who is a trickster and tricks power. The power in the case of the raven tail is the chief, and I won't tell the whole story, but the chief is the keeper of the sun, the moon, and the stars, and the world is dark, and the raven tricks the chief into releasing the sun, the moon, and the stars into the world. And so the trickster god in this case is both a trickster and a liar, because he has to play tricks in order to get the chief to give it up, but he's also a savior, which is one of the paradoxes of tricksterism. It's in the words of the yes men, they tell lies in order to reveal a greater truth. So that's one good example. A second example that I do go into some depth in the book and is a little bit more difficult to follow, but there's this amazing Richard Pryor routine from 1979 where he does a very raw description of the kinds of chokeholds that police use on unarmed black men and kill them exactly the way George Floyd was murdered. Of course, this had been going on already for decades when Richard Pryor worked it into his routine in 1979. But my theory is that the power was in that audience. He was speaking to a mostly white audience, and they're laughing. He's telling this like it's a joke, describing a chokehold that kills unarmed black men, and there the audience is laughing. And so in the book I write about, well, why are they laughing? There's absolutely nothing funny about this. And my theory is that people laughed because what Richard Pryor was describing was so uncomfortable, and he planted a seed with that audience. They're laughing, and as they're laughing, they're asking themselves, why am I laughing? This is so absurdly wrong. And maybe it took 40 years for the punchline to be delivered, because 40 years later, we have this reckoning where a much larger number of Americans are aware of this. Pryor even talks about how black folks knew exactly what he's talking about. It was news to a lot of white folks. So he planted a seed. So if you think of the white majority in this country as being the power structure, and you think of his not so funny joke as a trick, he tricks that power structure into performing the act of love that we're involved in right now, which is a reckoning with this police practice to make sure that it stops happening. Mm-hmm. I could give a couple more examples if you like.
Yeah, that would be great. And I really appreciated you bringing up the murder of George Floyd. And it's fascinating, you know, that you pieced together this Richard Pryor piece from 1979. And I want to ask you something about policing now and what you're talking about, but give me a couple more examples too.
Yeah, I mean, they're not that easy to come by. The tricking power part happens all the time. Tricking power into performing an act of love is a little bit more difficult. I think one of the great attempts, I think the folks who are around right now, who have been around, I think, since the 90s and the early part of this century, that do a wonderful job of playing with this dynamic of the yes men. What happened was Union Carbide, before it was owned by Dow Chemical, had a fertilizer plant in Bhopal, India. The plant exploded. I think 19,000 people died. A huge number of people died. And then future generations had all kinds of birth defects. It was really pretty terrible. And that was this exercise of power, was that they put this fertilizer plant in a place where they could get away with it around a lot of poor people who needed jobs in India. And then after this disaster that killed and maimed so many people, they paid the families of the deceased a mere pittance through negotiations with the government in India. So on the 20th anniversary, the Yes Men, their prank was to impersonate vice presidents of large corporations, and they put up fake websites and see who would take the bait. So they put up a fake website pretending that they were Dow Chemical and posing as vice presidents. And sure enough, a bankers association in England thought it was the real Dow Chemical site and invited them to speak to their conference. So these guys put on their suits and ties, and they go out to London. They get on BBC Four. So the whole country of England hears them get on, and impersonating vice presidents of Dow Chemical, they promise full reparations to the victims of the Bhopal tragedy. And then they give their speech, and in the speech at the bankers' conference, they do the same thing. The beauty of their tricks is it's really no fun, and you really don't get to make your point unless you get caught. So they love getting caught. So they get away with it momentarily, and then they get caught. And as their slogan is, they were tricking. They tell lies in order to reveal a greater truth. So what happens is that it's exposed as a hoax, but it had such great publicity. In fact, Dow Chemical's stock dropped precipitously that day, and they put Dow Chemical on the spot. It was kind of a win-win. Either Dow Chemical goes, you know, you're right, we didn't give proper reparations to the people of Bhopal, or they go, well, maybe you're right, but we've already sealed that deal and we're not giving him anything else, which is what happened. And I say it's a win-win because either the malfeasance of Dow Chemical gets exposed, which is what actually happened, or the people of Bhopal get some justice, which did not happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Yes Men are a great example, and I love that you mention them in the book. And I saw one thing that they did where they created a fake website and presented themselves falsely as some sort of corporate consultants. And they went to maybe IMF or WTO meetings, some huge meetings on money. And they were really advising this group of people to reestablish slavery. They didn't use the word slavery, but they had a PowerPoint presentation. And the people there were into it and asking questions, details about how they would go about doing that. Yeah, the Yes Men are really interesting and provocative. I mean, you mention in your book tons of tricksters. I think it would be great if you could say a few things about the attributes of tricksters, what it is that tricksters do a little more, and what all these people have in common. You're talking about Muhammad Ali, Sun Ra, Yoko Ono, Buster Keaton, the Marx Brothers, Mae West, the Yes Men, Timothy Leary, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Abby Hoffman, the organization Earth First. They all present their tricksterism in different ways, for sure. What are the general attributes of trickster? Right.
Yeah, I love talking about that. There are 10. Your listenership's just going to have to buy the book to get all 10, but I'm going to throw a few of them out there. And I should talk about what motivated me to write this book. This is my second book. The first one is on the same theme. The first one's called Disruptive Play. And I had to write Disruptive Play twice, because when I first started writing it, I was just researching the phenomenon of play, of playfulness. So Johan Huizinga's Homo Ludens was a main source. Fred Donaldson was a main source. Former UCSC professor Norman O. Brown, Love's Body, was a main source. And I wrote the whole thing, and then I went to a conference for the Association for the Study of Play, And I met someone there, and she looked at what I was doing, and she goes, you know, you really need to look into Trickster, which I was unfamiliar with Trickster as an archetype. So then I got familiar with Lewis Hyde's book from the late 80s, early 90s, Trickster Makes This World. I had to go back and rewrite the whole book in that context. So the idea from a Jungian perspective is that all of us as human beings contain all of the archetypes: the mother, the hero, the warrior, the trickster, the fool, the magician, the sage. There's not agreement on exactly what all the archetypes are, but there's a bunch of them. And the easiest way to explain it to get to the threshold of the attributes is, and this was the other motivation, is that this country is infatuated with the warrior archetype, and we swim in the waters of the warrior, which means that particular archetype, which is necessary and has its positive attributes, but this country has gone way too far in thinking that our problems can be resolved through conflict and by defeating our adversaries. And so it becomes hard to get our arms around other archetypes like the trickster. So I'm not saying we need to get rid of the warrior. I'm just saying that trickster needs to have their say. So I started doing research, and I realized every culture has a trickster god. And the way I talk about it in terms of like the people that you listed, John, is that is kind of like, I use Star Wars as an analogy. So Star Wars movies are about the hero and the warrior. So if somebody has the hero and the warrior is strong in them, you know, we say the force, that's the force. We say the force is strong with him. So some of the people I talk about are people in whom the trickster force is strong. So I started out in the beginning with a book called The Trickster by an anthropologist named Paul Radin. The book came out in 1956. And it retells the trickster tales of the oldest stories known to humanity of Wakchunkaga from the Winnebago tribe, which lived in what is now parts of Tennessee and Wisconsin and every places in between. And I'm reading these tales, and as I'm reading them, I'm noticing that they're very short tales. You could tell them or enact them in 5, 6, 7, maybe 10 minutes. And there's all these attributes and these qualities. And it dawns on me in the midst of my research that these are Bugs Bunny cartoons, and that the great American trickster is Bugs Bunny. So when anything I say is confusing to you, I say, just go watch some Bugs Bunny and you'll get the idea. So what are some of the attributes? First of all, as an archetype, a human being cannot be an archetype, which means, but a cartoon character or a god or goddess or demigod can. So Loki is a capital T trickster, but Abby Hoffman or Andy Kaufman are lowercase T tricksters, but the force is strong with them. Secondly, they're transgressive. They like to cross boundaries. They like to test the rules and break the rules. So little kids, you know, the force is strong with them, the trickster force, because anyone who's raised a kid knows that at some point they're going to test the rules and they're going to cross boundaries. And in fact, tricksters ultimately do not have gender. They often present initially as male, but they gender switch all the time. And once again, let's all remember how frequently Bugs Bunny cross dresses in the interest of tricking Elmer Fudd, and usually plants a nice big wet kiss on Elmer Fudd before the trick is completed. And I already mentioned one, how they're kind of liars and they're saviors, and people scratch their head. How could a savior be a liar? And when I use the word savior, I'm not looking for some messiah to show up and save the world. I think saviorness is a quality that we all have and that we can nurture. But the point of it, once again, yes men, telling lies to reveal a greater truth. If I got up, or someone got up in front of an audience and they started talking about how, well, we're gonna we're gonna solve this racism thing. We're gonna stop being racist. We're gonna stop being sexist, and we're gonna save the planet. We're gonna save whatever species are still left, and the world's gonna live at peace, and we're gonna have a lot of fun, and it's gonna be a wonderful utopian world. Well, is that person a liar or a savior? Right? They're both. So that's another attribute. And I think one last one I want to talk about, because, well, I'm going to talk about two more, because people always ask me, is Donald Trump a trickster? And I go, look, everybody's got some in them. Everybody's got some. So yeah, even Donald Trump has some trickster in him, but the force is not strong with him. Not everybody who plays tricks is a trickster. And this is the attribute where tricksters can be powerful, but it's a first principle. In other words, they're born that way, or they become powerful by playing a trick. But they don't wage wars. They don't raise armies. They don't amass power. So whether you're talking about Tricky Dick Nixon or Tricky Donnie Trump, they're not that part of them is not strong. The other attribute that then you were asking about all the attributes is that a trickster walks into that world of playing tricks knowing that a trick can backfire. And like in cartoons, you know, like with the coyote, who's also a trickster figure, where the dynamite is always blowing up in his face, or he grabs the anvil and he falls off the cliff, or even John Lennon and Yoko speaking from their bed during their honeymoon and saying, we're more than willing to be the world's clowns if it will help the world become a better place. So tricksters, it's not like they go looking to be humiliated, but they accept the risk of humiliation, and they know that some of their tricks might backfire. And this is also where people like Donald Trump fall down, because they have a lot of pride and they do not like it when anything backfires on them. They don't accept that. They don't have that willingness. So that's a bunch of them. There's 10. I came up with 10 attributes. If you've got a favorite, John, I'm glad to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. You were just talking about how the warrior archetype is just simply overused and present in our culture. And that's obvious. This country was built on violence. I think people are realizing that. So it's hard to get out of that cycle. And my whole lifetime, the United States has been at war, even though I grew up hearing that the huge war that happened just before my lifetime was the war to end all wars. And that just hasn't been so. In your book, there's a section where you're talking about Muhammad Ali, and then you write that tricksters are anti-war, and you're just mentioning a couple of crazy presidents we've had. And I just saw that yesterday or the day before, George Bush Jr. was giving a speech somewhere, and in a way, he pulled a Freudian slip trickster on himself, kind of. He's criticizing Putin invading Ukraine, but during the speech, he says, Putin, you know, this terrible invasion has happened of Iraq. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant Ukraine. He actually said that. He then blamed it on his age. Very interesting. I don't know if you want to say more about war and getting out of war mentality. I'll throw this in too. It seems to me that there's even a war on everything you're writing about, a war on the original primal indigenous cultural ideas about life, about trickster, about power, about collaboration, about what a community looks like. There's sort of been a destructive war on all of that, almost as if our origins as humans is embarrassing and wrong, and we need to really civilize it and improve it and make buildings and bombs. I don't know if you have anything to say about this war way and our way into something loving and playful and collaborative.
Yeah, you know, this is a good way to get back to some of your earlier comments about power, John. And so here's the interesting thing about tricksters. Let me just start by directly saying, look, if you've got power out there and they're doing something wrong, all we often can come up with is fighting power with power. And in the worst possible form of cultural play is war. That's this cultural play getting out of hand. I talk about three different kinds, so the three different kinds of playfulness, and look, the scholars of play have come up with 308 different forms of play and playfulness. I'm only going to talk about three. So original play is kind of this natural state that little babies have and all animals have. It's non-competitive. Think of it as frolic. Think of it as wrestling without clutching, biting, or hitting, or tickling. It's certainly not sexual. It's just like being happy to be alive and being playful with others. And then you get cultural play is where that kind of playfulness evolves into a game where you keep score and you have winners and losers. And there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself, but it's gotten out of hand. And when it gets completely out of hand, you've got war. Short of war, you've got, I mean, this is my latest campaign because, you know, we're all in front of computer screens and our phones so much. And I remember in the earlier days of the internet, when you like went to an article you wanted to read, you could sit at your computer and read the article. But now you're bombarded with ads that pop up and go away and take over your screen while you're trying to read. That's a form of cultural play. That person who is marketing to you is trying to win your attention. And after they win your attention, then they're trying to win your credit card number and get you to buy something. So that's a form of cultural play too. And so is like professional sports. And I'm a big sports fan, but I think there's way too much money invested in it. And it's another example of it getting out of hand. So that's cultural play. So disruptive play is what the trickster does. And the trickster introduces original play into the cultural play arena. So a real simple and somewhat banal example is when these guys used to go streaking, you know, and they'd go to an NFL game and take their clothes off and run naked onto an NFL field in the middle of the game. So that game is this intense and serious form of cultural play. The guy running naked onto the field is original play, and he's disrupting the game, which they do not appreciate, and that person gets arrested and taken away. So tricksters do that kind of thing, and they're not thinking about good and evil. They're not thinking about right and wrong. They're just thinking about having fun. The only question they ask is, wouldn't it be fun? So tricksters come from a pre-moral, or what Henry Louis Gates Jr. calls a morally indeterminate place. So people need to remember they're not evil, but they're not good either. They are stumbling through a journey that concludes with moral discovery. So to come back to your question, so why do you say tricksters are anti-war? I think being anti-war is the birth of the consciousness, moral and ethical consciousness of the trickster. But the reason they're against war is not because they're good and right and war is evil and wrong. They're anti-war because they just want to have fun. And there's nothing on this planet that is less fun than war. So it's a nice, clean way to get your morality started. You don't need a religious doctrine. You don't need somebody at a lectern lecturing you. You simply know when you see the violence of war, you see the pain, you see the suffering, you're going, well, that's not fun. I'm not going to do that. The beauty of the trickster is that they experience moral discovery through experience, not through doctrine, not through study, not through somebody teaching or inculcating a preformed morality on them, but they come to morality through a much deeper sense by experience.
This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org, broadcasting from the University of California at Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. You're listening to an interview with Shepard Siegel, author of the new book, Tricking Power into Performing Acts of Love, How Tricksters Through History Have Changed the World. Here again is Shepard Siegel. Talking about war and warriors, the police are the domestic warriors, and the last 50 years, even more so than originally. And police started out as slave catchers in this country, but have been armed more and more with military gear. I'm just wondering where you think the recent movements to either abolish police or defund police or dramatically change safety in our communities, where that fits in to tricksterism, if it does at all. And I'm wondering too, just your personal take on what's happened the last 2 years with the defund movement and Black Lives Matter movement. As I said before, you know, 2 years ago, the beginning of the pandemic, and George Floyd was killed, and this huge outcry around the whole world, defund the police, abolish the police. Here in Santa Cruz, in a lot of cities across the country, there started to be discussions about shifting some of the emergency calls that go to police to unarmed EMT people with expertise in mental health crisis work. There's a group in Eugene, Oregon called CAHOOTS that's been doing this for 30 years, and they take 20% of the emergency calls. It costs much less. They've never hurt anyone, and they've never been hurt. All of that momentum seems to have fizzled, and other things are present for people. The pandemic continues. There's an economic crisis. More wars are happening. I don't know your thoughts on, specifically on the potential for changing policing. And I'm feeling a little concerned that the momentum around that has fizzled a little bit.
Okay, well, you kind of hit an unexpected nerve with me on that. It is an issue I think about a lot. Let me just start out with the image from the anti-Vietnam War era when the female hippie puts a flower in the barrel of a gun and tries to trick power into performing an act of love. I certainly would like to see our communities work together better. So here's, let me just say it. Here's the nerve you hit with me. I'm an old man now. And why did I wait so long to write this book? The original inspirations for this book happened when I was like 15 years old, and it was in the middle of that anti-war thing, but I chose a career in education, and I worked in public education for a few decades. And the last job I had with the public school system was I was the vocational director for Seattle Public Schools. One of our vocational programs was criminal justice program. So if you are running we try to call it career and technical education now. I don't think it's ever stuck. So, but more people understand what vocational education is, and it's the radical notion that a student should learn how to do something while they're in high school. But I want to tread lightly here. But at any rate, I was frustrated because I would meet with high school principals here in my glorious city that I love, of Seattle. I'd meet with high school principals and I said, look, you know, especially in certain parts of town here, you've got kids in your school, and when the bell rings and school's over, they're out hanging on the streets and they're getting in trouble. And they're getting in trouble with the police, and they're getting in trouble with police who come from blue-collar suburbs not far from Seattle that are mainly white, and the kids getting in trouble are mainly kids of color. I go, what would you think about having this program in your high school, and then maybe we can raise our own kids from our own neighborhoods to be the policemen and policewomen of the future, and they'll know, they'll have a more insight and understanding, and they'll even know the families of these kids that they're meeting afterwards. And this, you know, terrible thing I'm about to say, because it causes me no end of being upset, is that some of these high school principals were more comfortable demonizing the police and making them their enemy than they were about actually changing the situation and maybe changing the makeup. I mean, right now as I speak, our city of Seattle is, we've got over 300 vacancies in the police force, and they're talking about refilling those vacancies, and part of the funding is going to go to relocation fees to help candidates move here from somewhere else to become police officers here. They're not even talking about raising our own people. And so to me, you know, that may not be as transformative a step as the kinds of things that a concept like defunding the police may be, but it's really a step in the right direction. I don't know about other cities, but I don't see our city taking that step. So I do think you're raising a really good question, because what I hear you asking, John, is how do we reformulate the power? And it's a power that at this point in history, we need to have some kind of power in our community, but maybe we should only have it when it's really necessary. And I'm right there in Northern California, I think it's Sunnyvale, just over the hill, that I think is doing very similar to what was the city you just said was doing it?
Eugene, Oregon.
Eugene, Oregon, yeah. That Sunnyvale's been doing this for a long time too. So obviously, yeah, redirecting the calls to social service agencies makes a ton of good sense. But I think raising our own young people and creating good career opportunities for them in, let's just call it public safety, whether it's paralegals or social work or policing, we should and ought to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I bet you weren't expecting that answer.
I didn't know for sure. And I think people, the idea of getting rid of the police is scary for people generally. I have focused on policing a lot since I moved to Santa Cruz, and I saw someone killed by Santa Cruz police, actually.
Oh my.
And then I helped to create a police review board. I spent 5 years doing that. Then I served on the board. I resigned from the board. I'm a little skeptical about improving policing in the way that I would be skeptical about improving war making, actually, very, right. Very similarly. I think temporarily, it's a great idea. Actually, not even temporarily. The people who serve us in safety, healthcare, education, they should know us. So in a sense, localizing is a bit of a general solution to a lot of our problems.
No, it's. I think you're raising a good question, because yeah, and this is where we started out, like what is the nature of power? And you know, I'm just almost done with The Dawn of Everything by Grabow and Wengrow. And I love this line, why would we ever let anybody else tell us what to do? And that's usually where the trouble starts with police, is where they exert their authority, rightly or wrongly, and nobody likes that. Mm-hmm. And you have to bow down to their domination, especially if you're black, to get the hell out of that situation. Mm-hmm. That's just not the right dynamic.
This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org, broadcasting from the University of California at Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. You're listening to an interview with Shepard Siegel, author of the new book, Tricking Power into Performing Acts of Love, How Tricksters Through History Have Changed the World. Here again is Shepard Siegel. I love that you say that music is the most accessible art form, and that some would say the most magical. I don't know if you want to say more about Black culture and it being a real root for trickster ways and all of these art forms that can embrace tricksterism.
Sure. In the research I've done, and like I said, there's a trickster god in every culture. And the one who has fascinated me the most is Eshu, also known as Eshualegwa or Eshualegba, who comes from West Africa. And it's the spirit of Eshu that has influenced not just African-American, but what I prefer to call Afro-Atlantic culture, everywhere from Brazil, where Eshu was... is considered a political liberator to Cuba and the Caribbean, and of course the southeastern United States, from which it then became this great African American culture that took over. And it's just something I was around from a very young age. I mean, I was around when A Love Supreme came out, you know, so I got influenced by that record and what John Coltrane was about at a very young age. I want you to know, the first time I ever encountered Sun Ra was in Santa Cruz, California, and he played at the Civic in Santa Cruz in the 70s. God knows how I ended up in that auditorium that night, but it was an experience I'll never forget. And trust me, I've forgotten a lot of stuff from back then, but this one I will never forget, because they all came out in their space age outfits. You know, it's the style that George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic and more recently Janelle Monáe have borrowed, this Afrofuturist garb. And I'd never seen anything like it in my life, and I really shall never forget it. There's been some great musicians that somehow have passed through Santa Cruz. I think the thing I want to say about Sun Ra, two things I want to say. The first is, I don't see him as a trickster. By his own admission, he's an angel. And he also claims not to be an earthling, claims really to be more at home in Saturn than on Earth. And I'm cool with that. But the reason he's included in the book is that he created a climate around his community of musicians. I mean, he invented the DIY approach to making records. And in the early days of his band, the only place you could get his records was at his shows. They weren't carried in record stores. You had to go to a show and buy one of his records there. And he was like the first guy to popularize that, where the band, they all lived in the same house together in Chicago, in New York, and in Philadelphia. They practiced 10 hours a day. And they just created such a spiritual climate around them and their music that it's those kinds of things, you know, whether you're talking about the early days of Burning Man, or you're talking about the Bay Area in the 60s, or you're talking about Sun Ra, you create a climate where it's okay for a trickster to come out and play. And the trickster doesn't always have to be confronting power. Sometimes trickster just wants to come out and play and dance and enjoy. And that's why it's important to talk about Sun Ra. I want to say one other thing about him. Before his musical career took off, he and his colleagues started this theosophical spiritual group called Themae. And Themet was, you know, it was in Chicago, and it was at the same time that Nation of Islam was growing. And Themet was distinct. It was the same as Nation of Islam in the sense that it was put out there for the African-American people of the south side of Chicago, but it was different in that Nation of Islam was kind of counter-racist and found it necessary to demonize the white man, whereas Themet was more like a hippie philosophy, if you will. It was more of preaching a world where we're all at peace with each other. So it was a little bit more playful in that sense, and it was more peace-loving. And I'm not saying there weren't valuable critique coming out of Nation of Islam, but I'm just saying that Sun Ra's message was distinctly different.
This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org, broadcasting from the University of California at Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. You've been listening to an interview with Shepard Siegel, author of the brand new book, Tricking Power into Performing Acts of Love, How Tricksters Through History Have Changed the World.